All right, so I'll tell you now, this is a leadership talk that's kind of dressed up to look like a data analysis exercise. When I was first asked to put this together, it was by a division chief, senior manager at NASA, who all of the people that control the systems the International Space Station worked for. At the time, I was an executive. And he called me and says, hey, I want you to just come give them some kind of leadership, some kind of rah-rah talk, which I was kind of known for. So I said, all right, that's what I'm going to do. What did I do? I came and talked to them about data analysis. As we go through this, by the time we get to the end, I think the leadership point that I'm trying to make is going to become abundantly clear. Anytime I'm talking about critical thinking, and if we talk about it, certainly in the mission control part of NASA, I assure you what we are talking about really is, what are all the things that can screw you up and you will make mistakes, or you will ignore the obvious answer that's in front of you. In some cases, you won't even see it. But when you see it, you will sometimes make a decision that's in conflict with the data that's right in front of you. How does that happen to us? We're going to go through that right now. By the way, this is interactive. So as we go through this and I ask questions, they're not rhetorical. So as I ask questions, feel free to answer. There's no wrong answer. You'll see. Actually, there are some wrong answers, but they have nothing to do with the data analysis piece. Now, the way I have most of it structured is exactly the way I first gave it to these folks in Mission Control, for what it's worth. I added some things at the end to really hammer on the leadership message that I'm trying to make. We'll ignore my instructions. So we have a couple of sets of data that we're going to go through. This is the first set. This is really just about pattern recognition, something that we do in Mission Control all the time. Now, you don't know what this is, which, by the way, is one of the points of the exercise. Because without knowing what it is, you're free to really just think about, do I see a pattern? Do I see what looks like normal behavior? Do I see a change in behavior? And what do I think is going to happen next? And by the way, these are two physical measurements. So take it could be like a temperature, a motor voltage, motor speed, you name it. Two different physical measurements taken at the same time. So question I have for any of you is, do you see what looks like normal behavior for either of these measurements? Kind of a pattern, and it looks like it repeats, right? It's not perfect. So each next period doesn't lay right on top of the previous one. And the two measurements, they tend to track each other, don't they? Although, again, it's not perfect. Do you see anything that looks like a change in behavior? Yes, sir.
Speeding up as we go across in time, seems like a pattern picking up.
Periodicity? Oh, your period's changing? What about, anybody notice the shape of the line? Gets kind of ratty, it gets kind of fuzzy out here, right? We call that noisy. What do we think is going to happen next with these two measurements based on what we know so far? Do you think the pattern's going to change? Do you think it's going to keep repeating? Overall behavior looks about the same. Sure be good to know what this fuzzy stuff is, right? But for the most part, it looks like it's going to keep going, right? If anybody disagrees, feel free to shout out. All right, here's a different data set. This is a single measurement. Same idea as the last one, pattern recognition. Do you see what looks like normal behavior in this measurement? Do you see anything that looks like a change in behavior in this measurement? Where's the change? Right here? So if that changed, what was the behavior before that? Okay, so whatever this measurement was tended to stay down here before. Something changed, then it went above the line, right? What do we think is going to happen next with this measurement? Could come back down, right? Last thing it did was go up. What's our confidence level that it's going to come back down? Now remember, this is a different measurement than that one that we saw on the previous page. So what do we think, what other possibility do we have here? Could it keep going up? What would we have to know to be able to tell whether or not it's going to go up or come back down? More data, right? Go back in time, essentially. Or know what it is, but that's cheating. So this plot is the same measurement. In fact, the top measurement, the blue and the orange stuff, fits between the two arrow points you see on the right. And you can see there's that kind of S shape to the curve right there. It matches that S shape right there, even though it's a different format. But it's 10 times more data. It goes back 10 times further in time. So to your point, now we have more data. So with 10 times more data, what do we think normal behavior is for whatever this measurement is? Looks like it. Not perfect, right? I mean, that's a little funky looking. So it might be sinusoidal. What do we think happens next now that we know 10 times more, right? So now we might have more confidence it's going to come back down. What about the possibility that it, whatever this is going to keep going up? Is there a greater or less possibility of that based on what we know now? Less? Okay. What would we need to know to tease this one out in order for us to predict better? More data, right? So there we go. Now it's 10 times more data again. So all of the data now on the green plot fits down here between these two arrowheads. Now we go 10 times further back in time. Now what do we think normal behavior is? Oscillating about whatever that line is right there, right? That's troublesome. In fact, frequently when we look at this, when we look at data like this in the engineering world, we'll say, you know, that looks pretty well behaved. I mean, the periods are different, but whatever this measurement is tends to dither around whatever that line is. If we ignore that, of course, in the real world, you can't ignore that because it kind of messes up our predictions on what's going to happen next. But based on this now, what do we think happens next in our system? We think it's going to go up? Do we think it's going to go up and run away like this suggested? Ultimately, do we expect it to stay around this line or do we expect it to do something different? Probably. Maybe. Except for that, that's sure troublesome, right? If we had more data, we might know the answer to this one too. By gosh, there we go. Last one on this series, by the way. This is 100 times more data, which, by the way, for those doing the math, is 10,000 times more data than we started with that very top plot. In fact, that top plot fits about the size of one pixel on this purple chart. All of this data fits right there. Now we know 10,000 times more. What do we think normal behavior is for whatever this system is? Going to go back above the line? Of course, you can't tell on this plot. Technically, it is above the line because it's at this point right here, right? But it's so thin you can't see it. But I agree. You see it peaking up above the line, and then it drops way back down. Where does this measurement spend most of its time, above or below the line? Below. What do we expect to happen in the future? Expected to stay below most of the time anyway, right? Anything else? Do you notice any change in behavior at all in that last data set? Those peaks? Yeah, you're right. You look at these peaks. Actually, you can go all the way back to the start, and the peaks look like they're growing a little bit. The widths, they're not exact, but they tend to be about the same, although these are a little differently behaved than these. But certainly out here, they look about the same, at least if you kind of squint a little bit, right? Overall, it looks like it's going to keep behaving like this, right? Again, don't let me put words in your mouth, even though that's what I'm doing. Okay? Before we move on, I have a question for you. Were we wrong? So, for example, suggesting that or guessing that this whatever this measurement is could keep running away, was that a bad guess or was it wrong when we guessed it? Why not? Didn't have enough data. Right. That's a good answer too. In fact, we were wrong, right? There's really low confidence that whatever this measurement is going to keep running away. But based on what we knew, it was a good answer. My message to my folks in Mission Control is be careful about latching on to whatever your original answer was, whether it was this data or 10 times more, 100 times more. As you get more data, make sure you're willing to back up and ask yourself, now why did I have that other opinion? Why did I think that before? I've seen more data. Am I willing to change my opinion? In fact, am I willing to accept that I was wrong or that we were wrong as a team? Is that okay or not? Because in fact, where we get into a lot of trouble is frequently individually we don't like admitting I'm wrong. We don't like saying that about the team. We're passing judgment. As a leader, when you realize we just learned something in this way we've always done this, in fact, is wrong. As a leader, if you're not willing to call that out and tell the folks who work for you, hey, look what we just learned. We've had this mistake in our system or in our process for years, for a decade. I was the guy that came up with it, or maybe the person that came up with it is in the room. We just realized we're wrong. The beauty of that is if you can do that, you can then take that next step and say, but here's what's right. Here's how we're now going to fix it and not be wrong anymore. And it's really hard to turn that corner and be willing to accept, hey, I was wrong about that before. But it's not about me defending my honor and always and saying that I was right before when I didn't have as much information. It's all about, am I willing to step up and say I've now learned something that I realize I've been making this mistake? All right, we're going to go to a different kind of data, bar charts. This isn't really pattern recognition. In this case, this is all about picking out significant data points versus insignificant data points or data that's in the noise. Now, the way we would use this in engineering or in a lot of fields, say medicine, you have a certain amount of money you can throw at causes of death, and you can't solve everything. So if the same amount of dollars could solve any problem, which ones do you solve, the big ones or the small ones? So for instance, this bar chart counts up some physical thing, like maybe causes of cancer. If you have a finite amount of budget, you go after the one that causes the most cancer or kills the most people with cancer, right? So given that, and the same thing's true in engineering, you have a certain amount of budget, or in any management job, certain amount of budget, certain amount of people to throw at problems. You want to pick out your big ticket items. We solve those, we solve most of our problems, most of our cost problems, most of our technical challenge. And the ones that are in the noise, you tend to ignore because now you're throwing a whole lot of money for very little gain. So given that, as we look at these bar charts, where do you draw the line and say, these are the ones that are most significant that we're going to focus on first? How many of these bars would you look at? First two? Maybe the first four? Where would you draw the line and say, these are clearly in the noise? Last three? Last four maybe, right? Certainly there's a big difference in the height between these bars. And there's not much more to it than that, right? You don't know what these things are, but boy, when you look at it, if for the same money you could solve these problems, or you could solve these problems that are many, many times the size of these, you go after these ones that stick out. Engineering's not all that hard, is it? Here's another one. Where do you draw the line? Where's the big ticket item or items on this page? First three, or maybe even the first one. Which ones are in the noise? Just the last two? Last six? So somewhere in this range, right? In here, we don't even know what this is, and we have trouble drawing the line, right? Although these are almost five times, certainly four times the height of these. So whatever this is four times the problem that these two are, right? So clearly it stands out. But these are big enough, certainly compared to these others, that if you solve this, clearly you're going right after these next. But somewhere down here, these certainly look like they're in the noise, right? Okay, last one. Unfortunately, this is what management and leadership problems look like. In fact, this is what most engineering problems look like. So now we have to draw the line, and we're going to focus on the stuff that really matters. Now where do you draw the line? Four. So that would be right here. Where would you draw the line and say they're in the noise? In here? Or further to the right? Right about here? So if these are all in the noise, somewhere in here, these are kind of intermediate. They're big enough compared to these that they get our attention. But certainly somewhere in this range, these must be the really significant ones, or the big ticket items, right? Okay. So now we go back to our first data set. This is what I call the full disclosure mode. So now we talk about what the data is. Recall what the conclusion was for these two measurements. Some kind of repeating cycle, and they get a little fuzzy here. We don't know what's going on here. That changes compared to the first parts of the measurement, but we expect the pattern to keep repeating, right? Is that how you remember it? That plot on top is average carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and the bottom one is average temperature, both of them based on Antarctica ice cores going back 400,000 years. Recall what we said. Now think about what's in the headlines now. What did we say? That both the CO2 level in the atmosphere and the average temperature are on some periodic cycle that appears to be about 100,000 years wide, and whatever it is, certainly looks like it's going to keep on repeating, and we don't see anything that looks like a change yet. By the way, as for the fuzziness here in this measurement, most scientists attribute that to the number of samples that we have in this range. So more samples means you have more points on the line, so the line looks a little rattier. Right? That's an interesting observation considering what's been in the press for the last 15 or 20 years on global warming. Recall what we decided here. Whatever this is here, this thing could be cyclic, could come back down, might run away from us until we had 10,000 times more data. And then it's clear whatever this is usually below this line, although the peaks appear to be growing in these last five or six cycles, right? What do we expect to happen in this system as we go forward? for the most part, stay below the line. For the most part, it looks like the pattern's going to repeat, although we may see the peak continue to go up like we have, right? Now, you probably can't read that. What is this? Average temperature in the atmosphere for the last 150 years, last 1,000 years, last 10,000 years, and then on the bottom, last 1 million years. In fact, at that point right there, that's 400,000 years. If we change that scale a little bit, you would see that curve exactly the same shape as the curve on the previous page. Interesting. And what did we conclude? That when we look at 150 years, it sure looks like, wow, there's a great possibility that whatever this is changed its behavior here and is going up. And why does that get our attention? Because the Industrial Revolution happened right about in here. This is the early 1800s through the 1900s, and then it was after World War II that worldwide industry really shifted up, which in many places, including in various UN reports, is absolutely attributed to the possibility that this temperature now is running away from us. But by the time we see a million years worth of data, what does that tell us? Pattern sure looks like it's repeating. And if this was all we knew, it was fooling us. Most of us in the public, by the way, only know this. We don't know this bottom chart at all. But once we know that, it sure makes us feel less confident that something has changed in the system here, and that whatever this temperature is running away. Another interesting data point for you. These peaks right here at the top, those peaks are each about 100,000 years apart. The last peak was about 100,000 years ago. Show of hands, anybody that knows when recorded history started for human civilization? Anybody know? 10,000 years ago, which would put it at the beginning of this plot, or right there at the head of that arrow point, right in there is the beginning of recorded human civilization. And yet those peaks in those cycles had been going up for at least half a million years, if not longer, for a process that we see to be repeating every 100,000 years. My message to you isn't to preach to you about global warming or average global temperature, by the way. It's that line on the bottom. When I first put this together, this was all about the folks in mission control and making sure that they were remaining or keeping the difference between what they know versus what they think. I don't care what your data says. I know what I think about this. Well, we don't have any place for that in flying spaceships and mission control. And it doesn't help you as a leader to just know in spite of what the data is telling you. Whereas the line at the bottom says, our job's ruled by data. Make sure you understand the full context, not just the limited view that happens to support what you thought going in. Now, you are a very well-behaved audience. Most audiences, when I say most audiences, I mean more than 9 out of 10 audiences, when I go through this exercise with them, I already have people yelling at me about this global temperature thing. Being cadets, especially in the presence of people like Colonel Allison here, perhaps yelling at me, isn't on the menu for the day. The reason people yell at me is because they know what they think. They've seen it in the press. People they trust, people who they value, have told them what's going on. How dare I suggest that something's different? In fact, the reason I use this data is for that very reason. In fact, I have a book that I wrote, and I use this example in the book, and somebody reviewed the book for me and sent me a note and said, I think you need to take this out. It's not considered acceptable to talk about it. People are going to blacklist you for saying it. Of course, have any of you heard me say that the climate's not warming up? In fact, what does the data suggest? It is warming up, right? It's clear it's warming up, but it's already up here at pretty close to the peak, so it's going to drop off. In some ways, we need to send God a thank you note that civilization has actually been the last 10,000 years in what scientists used to call the thermal optimum, because it's so conducive to life on the planet. I'll get off that soapbox. We'll go to a different soapbox, different set of data, our bar charts. So recall we said here, first couple clearly stand out as the big ticket items. These are definitely in the noise. These we could arm wrestle over, are they significant or are they somewhere in the middle? They clearly are bigger than the ones that we would declare in the noise. Vehicular deaths, these are from 2009 U.S. Census Bureau data. only, and the reason it's 2009, by the way, is I pulled these charts together in 2012, and 2009 was the latest data that the Census Bureau had available. I mean, we're the government. You can only add stuff up so fast. Now, what this is telling you is, so this bar chart here, this is the number of people killed in passenger cars. This next bar is light trucks, which, by the way, is Census Bureau for pickup trucks. My personal opinion, if we were being intellectually honest, you would take the light truck bar and you would put it on top of the passenger car bar, and it would be way up here, which means we would say all of these are probably in the noise, not just these down here. But we'll leave it like this. One of the things I really like about this is motorcycle riders. Look how safe riding a motorcycle is compared to being in a car or a pickup truck. Pointed that out to my wife because I have a motorcycle, and she said, yeah, you're still an idiot. Same number of people get killed every year as are killed by getting hit by a car. None of you worried about walking over here today? I shouldn't be chastised for having a motorcycle. My wife did not buy the argument. By the way, I've also been called out on that one. Many, many more people are actually at risk of dying in cars and in pickup trucks because more people are in them than are on motorcycles. Also part of critical thinking. My wife didn't want to point that out. She just wanted to stick with the you're an idiot theme. Okay, so on this set of bar charts, recall we said this first one stands out and is significant. These in here somewhere are in the noise, and these are in that next level. Ooh, murder weapons. That's what these are. Uh-oh. There we go. Murder weapons. That first bar is handguns. The second bar that you can't really read says firearms of unknown or unspecified type. So some kind of gun. But we don't know what kind of gun it is. That next one, though, at about the same level, knives. So about the same number of people were stabbed to death as were shot with whatever kind of gun this is that we don't know. That's interesting. Note down here, shotguns and rifles. Down here in the range that we said were in the noise, certainly compared to this first one. That's interesting, too. Especially, again, considering things that have been in the news for a while about, oh, I don't know, the Second Amendment, the right to bear arms, or whether or not we should have certain types of long weapons, or they should be outlawed. Compare that against, say, oh, where the heck to go? There we go. Knives or cutting instruments. Interesting. We'll come back to that one in just a minute. So recall I said this is the one that most of our management decisions look like. Now, this particular set of bar charts, I cheated. I took both those two previous sets of bar charts, and I put them all together. So this is all the ones that we already voted on, but all in one big bar chart, which means, there we go. Those kind of light green ones there, those are the ones that we said stood out and were significant before when we looked at them separately. These yellow ones here, those are the ones that most audiences, including this one, tends to say, well, those are in the middle. I'm not sure about those in the middle. All the rest to the right of the yellow bars were the ones that we declared were in the noise when we were looking at them in separate bars. We'll come back to those three blue bars that we haven't talked about in just a few minutes. What I want to point out is, you see those two red ones that just popped up right there? I'll be darned. Shotguns and rifles again. Huh. Here's the interesting thing about that. Not that I have a particular axe to grind about the Second Amendment or these two things. See that red bar right there? That red bar is these two bars stacked up. And those two bars, if you take all shotgun-related and rifle-related deaths total in a single year and stack them up, darned if the same number of people aren't bludgeoned to death every year with a blunt object. Which means they got beaten to death with a crowbar or a stick of some kind, or an old school phone back in the day when we actually had phones. Same number of people. If you were to take that bar and then stack it on top of this yellow bar right there, that yellow bar, by the way, happens to be the one that said unspecified or unknown type of firearm. Let's just assume for argument's sake that bar, every single one of those murders, that weapon was an automatic assault rifle, not a weapon of unknown kind, not a shotgun, but an automatic assault rifle. When we look at what it's sitting right next to, pedestrians. So more people are hit and killed by a car every single year than are killed by every single person that was murdered by a firearm that wasn't a handgun. And yet we are risking constitutional crisis over the Second Amendment, over automatic assault rifles. It looks horrific in the news, doesn't it? But when we stand back and look at it dispassionately, not for the individual or the individuals who are affected by it, but when we think about it as a national problem, more people are hit by cars than are killed by all of those firearms. And by the way, in a bad year, somewhere less than 300 people total are killed by automatic assault rifles, which is not my way of saying, so we all ought to be packing M16s walking down the streets or shooting Bambi with M16s. Not my point at all. But going back to, if we're going to pick the big ticket items to fight about and to inject emotion into the country with, are we sure we're going after the right thing there? See, it looks to me like we ought to keep people off the damn streets. And that one right there next to pedestrians, make sure I'm reading the right one. Oh yeah, that's my motorcycle one. Yeah, we're going to stay off that one because my wife likes that one. This one down here, knives and cutting instruments. It's below all those other firearms, but not much below. Certainly right there in the same order of magnitude as the number of people that are stabbed to death every year. Which brings us to our three blue ones that aren't labeled. Those three blue ones that aren't labeled, the first one is total number of coalition deaths in Afghanistan and Iraq from the start of hostilities in 2001 through 2012. And again, the only reason that it ends in 2012 is that's when I put this chart together. If you were to update it to 2017, it would just be a little bit taller. The three bars would only be a little bit taller than they are now. Again, by comparison, what would I say about this? Think about the total magnitude of that blue bar, total number of deaths in the entire conflict compared to how many people are killed in pickup trucks and cars. And especially if you stick that pickup truck bar on top of the cars, think about how many people die in cars every single year compared to the number of coalition soldiers who have lost their lives in the Middle East since hostilities began. And yet we're not talking about car-related deaths. Or this one right here, which is all the deaths in Iraq. This one here, all the deaths in Afghanistan, which, by the way, is less than the total number of people that are hit by cars every single year. And yet we're not talking about that as the same huge crisis. When these bars are total number of deaths in the theater for the entire campaign. Makes you think, doesn't it? I'm not telling you what the answer is after you've been thinking about it, but it certainly makes you think. And that's the point. Be careful about what you know. Be careful about when you decide this is the thing that's worth fighting over, when you accept this risk every day and we're not even talking about it. Are you sure the thing that we're fighting about is the thing that we should be talking about, or that we should be fighting about it in the first place? Which, like carrying the M16 down the street, my point isn't that. So get off the DOD, get off the White House, let them go send soldiers into harm's way wherever they want. Not my point. But it's easy to watch the news and to think we are decimating the generation. You think about, well, yeah, but I don't think we're principally decimating the generation with these three bars. Hell, we're running over them with our cars, or we're allowing them to die on the streets every single day, and we're not talking about those same risks. Interesting, isn't it? So here is my point to the folks in Mission Control. Here is some of my point to you, wrapping this back to what does this mean besides for pattern recognition or data analysis of any kind. What do we need people in Mission Control to do? What do we need you as leaders to do? Be open and deliberate in your thought processes. That is being critical in your thinking. Which means as you start developing your opinions, especially as you start developing strong opinions, seek alternate opinions or alternate perspectives. Seek out folks that you know don't agree with you and find out why they don't agree. And then think about what their rationale is based on your rationale. And be suspect that maybe you just have your opinion. You already know what you're thinking and you stopped thinking about it. You stopped evaluating the other point of view or the other information that you have, either that you did or that somebody on your team has. And sometimes it's not intentional. So this isn't my way of saying, hey, we all go into things and we know we're going to ignore the information. Frequently, if not most of the time, our brains do this for us subconsciously and we're not even aware that it's happening, which makes it even more difficult to guard against unless you keep reminding yourself, Hey, I feel really strongly about that. And the more strongly you feel, the warning signs should be going off. Maybe I'm not listening. I need to make sure I understand why I'm disagreeing with this person that I'm arguing with. Why do I agree? Why do I feel so strongly about what I think or what my team thinks or what my heroes think? Is it just because they're my guys or they're my heroes or it's my opinion and by God, I'm going to fight to win my position no matter what? Or is it because I know I'm right? I've evaluated the data. Here's everything we know. Here's why this is the right position. Or if I don't agree, if somebody shows me something and I disagree with their evaluation or some decision they want to make in the field, say in the military, or in running a business, why don't I agree? Is it just because it's different than how we've always done it? Is it because it's different than the way my heroes are always done it, and that guy raised me to be just like him? How dare they suggest we do it differently? Because that has nothing to do with what the actual information is and the right thing is. That now is just, I know how to do this, and I don't care what your data says. What if the way we've always done it is wrong? What if the answers that we've always come to before were wrong, and now we have new information? Now we finally know the world's not flat after all. Holy cow. Let's stop fighting over that one and move on. Or what if somebody throws out an idea and they don't have the data to back it up, but they've got an idea of a new way of doing things, some new challenge we're going to go after instead of trying to fix other challenges? What if they're wrong? What if the thing that we change now, it actually is changing us away from goodness, and we just don't have enough information to realize we're now starting to make the mistake? Are we sure we have enough data to reach our conclusions? Or did we jump to some conclusion? Are we open to that information as we get 10,000 times more data? Or whatever that is, are we willing to say, wow, we were wrong before. Now I get it. We're not going to make that mistake anymore. We're not going to be wrong about that anymore. What part of your decision-making can you defend, and which part of it is just because? Because all of it that's just because puts you at risk, and it puts the people who are following you at risk. And then lastly, what other information would you need in order to figure it out? Whether it's getting more data, bringing in some expert, somebody that has experience in whatever the question is, and asking what they think, and then comparing that to your experience and your rationale, the reason you made the decision. Be open, be deliberate. Suspect that you're at risk of giving into your biases or the people that you work with, people you work for, maybe even are giving into theirs. Nothing is the right answer just because it is. Never. Before we get to my last leadership point for you, I have a couple of plots that I want to show you. This isn't about pattern recognition necessarily. See the words here under this plot? This is two different data points. So two different sets of data that were found to behave exactly the same way. Any of you statisticians? Ah, great. I was hoping no, because that way I could say stuff and you wouldn't grade me and tell me what I get wrong. So I'll be careful. That correlation of 99.2, consider that, for you non-statisticians, consider that a measure of goodness. How closely do these two data sets actually match? How closely do they really behave? And you can tell, whether it's from the calculated correlation or just looking at the shapes of the curves, whatever these two things are, boy, they lay right on top of each other. It would be easy to look at these two data sets and say, there must be some relationship between whatever these phenomena are. Here's another one. Correlation here, 92.8%. Again, pretty good. Now, the goodness or the correlation isn't as high as it was on the previous one, but it's awfully darn good. Whatever these two things are, sure seem to track each other. One appears to affect the other one, right? These come from a book called Spurious Correlations. Correlation does not equal causation. In fact, the red line that you see on this plot here is the number of suicides in each one of these years that's caused by hanging or drowning. Now, why he picked that out, I do know. It's because the data fits if you pick out just those two phenomena. The black line, federal science budget. So space and technology budget from the federal government. How about that? As the federal science budget goes up, so do the number of suicides by hanging and drowning. Who knew? Of course, they're not actually related whatsoever, right? So you got to be careful about forming the opinion that clearly the federal science budget is affecting the number of people that kill themselves. By the way, if these curves went in different directions, you might actually have something there, but you'd have to do more work to find out how related they really are. But the fact that they correlate doesn't mean a thing about whether or not they're related. It's just interesting. Here's another one. This one was only 92.8%. So that was that second one we looked at. The red line is the number of bike deaths, you gotta hear me out on this one, by people that hit stationary objects. The black one is the number of law books that are published in a single year. Note how they track each other. Now, in this case, maybe there's some causation. Maybe they publish all those damn law books, they piled them up somewhere, and people are running into them in their bicycles. Probably not. Moral of this story, like the rest of the critical thinking stuff that we've talked about, is be careful about jumping to too quick a conclusion. In this case, statistical correlation in the behavior of the data means nothing about causation, where one thing actually affects the other thing. Does that make sense? Did I say any of that wrong? Ah, good, we'll stick with that. Okay. What's my bottom line on all this? What does all this mean to you in the aggregate as leaders? So think about it in mission control. What do we need from our people in mission control? You lead those people in mission control so that every time they do what they do, they're right. They always protect the astronauts, always get the mission done, and always bring them home. Always. That's your goal. And we have to know that the people in mission control, not just the leader in mission control, but the workforce, the individual people pushing buttons, controlling the systems, we have to know those people are going to make the right decisions in every single thing they do. Because some of what we do happens so fast, if we made a single mistake at the working level in the control room, it's all lost and we failed the astronauts. So as leaders, we have to make sure that we do our best in this critical thinking on the fly, and we're always right. Except that we all have biases. We all have these internal emotions. So again, in other less well-behaved audiences, people would be unhappy with me now for bringing up things like gun control, suggesting that maybe it's not as clear that we are causing global warming. And maybe it's not so clear that it's going to run away from us after all. Maybe not, but people have strong emotions about it, and there's lots of people that as you talk about things like that, they're no longer listening to you. And not just on those things, on all kinds of things. In fact, most of the people that get their backs up about those topics when they hear me talk aren't experts in climatology. They're not experts in analyzing data associated with weapons control or arms control in the United States. They're not experts at all. They just know what they think from a limited knothole and a limited understanding of the problem in the first place. But those strong feelings get in the way, and they drive us. They drive what each one of us thinks, whether it's at the working level. As you become leaders and have people working for you, you carry those strong biases, those emotions up with you. Your bosses have them. The people who work for you have them. And what that means is it takes courage to overcome those. And it takes all kinds of courage. First, it takes that courage like we talked about when we looked at some of those pattern recognition plots. Just to admit, I was wrong. Holy cow, look at that. I was so sure. In fact, I was so sure it makes me even more reluctant to say I was wrong because now I'm really looking like an idiot. Except for the fact that I was wrong. And it's hard to do that. It takes courage to say I was wrong. It takes courage to say we were wrong. Say you're on a team working for somebody that everybody looks up to, and you realize that some way you do business, that person invented, and you just realized, there's a better way of doing it. Having the courage to speak up and say that is a hard thing to come by because you know it's going to piss people off in the room. Might piss the boss off, might piss your peers off. How dare you suggest we weren't right before? It takes courage to overcome that. Or to be the one person in the room to say, I think the emperor has no clothes on this. Because what if you're the one that's right? What if everybody else has been missing something and hasn't been looking at all the information, and you're the one person that gave the team the opportunity to look up and say, wow, you're right. Now we're not going to make that mistake. Whether the mistake means you killed your astronauts, you failed in your military operation, or you bankrupt your business. Deliberate awareness, this integrity. If I was giving you a much longer leadership discussion, very specific integrity we groom into the people in mission control, which is all about what you hear me talking about in critical thinking, knowing the difference between what you know versus what you think. Being aware of when you are taking an opinion without having all the data, it just seems right. Sometimes you don't have more time to do any better than that, but you have to know you're doing it. Be deliberate, be aware that that's what you're doing. Because if you're not, as you start just knowing things or taking action because I don't care what the data says, I know what the right thing is, it starts getting in the way of your understanding of what the real right thing is. That's when you make mistakes that get people hurt that are working for you or with you. That's how you make mistakes that bankrupt companies or that fail in situations where they had every opportunity to do well and to succeed, except that everybody on the team just listened to you because you sure sounded so sure and they trusted you. Deliberate awareness, critical thinking, always keep yourself honest on why do I think this? Do I know the difference between what I know versus what I think? And that's everything I have for you on this subject. Questions from anybody? Sure. Now first, in general, perfect information, perfect risk-free decisions don't come by all that often. Or if they do, it's on easy stuff that you didn't really need leadership to do right anyway. On the things that really are taking risk, where you're venturing out into the unknown, or you're in an operational environment taking real operational risk, like flying airplanes or a military operation or NASA or oil and gas. There's all kinds of operational situations where you have real physical risk. In those cases, you can wait around for perfect information. There's always some next question that, man, if we just had a little bit more time to test it, a little bit more analysis, then it would be risk-free and we can go do it and we know we're gonna be perfect. And the cost for that goes up towards infinity. You know, people like to browbeat NASA because we cost so damn much. Space shuttle flights, by the end of the shuttle program, cost about $700 million per flight. $700 million per flight. SpaceX must be geniuses because those guys are doing it for a fraction of what NASA did it for. Except that SpaceX doesn't solve everything to the eighth decimal point like we were expected to solve, because we were expected to never fail. If we stayed on the pad at NASA, and this is going to sound like whining, but stay with me because I'm getting to my point. But think about it. If we didn't launch a shuttle because there was a thunderstorm in the area, that if lightning struck the shuttle during ascent could cause the external tank to explode, the country lost confidence in us and we were browbeat by the press for the obviously right answer. Or if we had technical problems, which by the way was about 89% of the time, technical problems that we caught and stopped the launch so that we could fix to make sure that we didn't launch with something that could cause an engine to blow up, NASA's lost its nerve. NASA's lost it and can't do this anymore. In spite of the fact that in 50 years, we had three accidents in flight, three. That cost us astronauts. In fact, every one of those times we stopped the launch and fixed a problem, we were doing right things. But what else were we doing? We were chasing perfect data and perfect information, which meant those flights cost about $700 million a year because of the amount of engineering hours it takes to have that kind of scrutiny and to be that perfect. How does SpaceX get away with being much cheaper? A great reason they get away with that is they don't have to put that much scrutiny in it. Hey, you got to crack a few eggs, got to blow up a few rockets. Elon Musk has said the same thing, and he's right. When you're launching a rocket that doesn't have people on it, or you're not launching a rocket that has the DOD's $1.5 billion NRO satellite on it that they're not going to get back if you blow it up for them, smart guy, right? But in other cases, you got to crack a few eggs, you blow up a rocket, blow up a pad. That's how we learn. And there's where you got to draw the line. Which things is it okay for me to fail at? Which things is it okay for me to even have less perfect data? Because if we blow this, it really doesn't matter. We're going to have learned something and we'll move on and do the next one. But spending an extra year or an extra 5 years studying it means by the time we do it, it just doesn't matter anymore. Hell, the technology's going to moved on. By the time we perfected that iPhone, that very first iPhone, Samsung's come out with the damn Galaxy 8. Got to get it out on the market now. Now I've switched touchy-feely or emotional subjects, right? So you can't keep studying it. In fact, my message to you isn't for critical thinking. Make sure you take the time to study everything so that it's perfect and risk-free, because that's not realistic. My message to you is make sure you know what the big ticket items are. Go after the ones that matter most. And as you think you solve them or solve them enough for whatever the risk is that you want to take, make sure you know why you think it. And it's not just because. By the way, I'll give you a little segue on this one based on our experience. And I talk about this in a lot of speeches. those three times I told you that we failed astronauts, we lost astronauts in spacecraft and they were trusting us to protect them. Each of those three times, we did not make an engineering mistake. The failure that led to them dying was leadership, and it was senior leadership that made decisions and held the community accountable to make decisions without having data, without having enough rigor to understand what we were doing. And we did it for reasons that shouldn't have mattered. And in fact, in all three of those cases, the community knew that they were real rocket science related problems that we weren't fixing, and we were going to go ahead and launch anyway because we all know that we have to. And the reason we had to in each one of those three cases was different. But in all three of those cases, the reason we had to was bullshit. And we did not actually have to risk those people's lives for that. And how did we do that? It wasn't because we were chasing the perfect answer. It was because we stopped thinking critically and started accepting risk and assuming that, well, you know what? We're NASA. In the case of Apollo 1, we had Mercury, we had Gemini, we've had all these flights. We've practically invented manned spaceflight. We're good at it. We can keep going, even though we all know there's all these problems with the rocket that might make it blow up. We're NASA. Everybody knows what we touch is gold. And then those three astronauts died right there on the pad. But we spent the next 19 years without a single accident. We get into flying shuttles, same thing. And the shuttle is this incredible thing. You compare the shuttle design to everything we'd ever flown before. In fact, anything any other nation's ever put in space, it defies explanation that we could have designed and built that darn thing in the 70s and then flown it for 3 years and have it done what it did. Which is why, after 19 years, we committed to go on a day we shouldn't have go for Challenger for reasons that didn't matter, with real engineering problems where the experts were telling us it's going to cause the rocket to explode. And I kid you not, but we had to go anyway. And we knew we could get away with it because we have done this for all this time. We've only had one accident, Apollo 1, and we all know what that was. That was different than this. Look at what we've done now. And then 17 years after that, we lose the Columbia crew, same thing. The problem that we lost the Columbia crew, most of the community knew that we had that problem, and most of the crew swept it under the rug because we had other problems and we have to go. And we didn't have to. We knew that what that problem was, and in fact, the parts of that problem that had been declared unsolvable, and one of the reasons we accepted things like foam coming off the tank as a risk, was because it was impossible to do anything about it, and even if something came off and hit the shuttle, it was impossible to fix it. You know how long it took us to solve those impossible problems after the Columbia accident? 6 months. 6 months. I know that because I led the engineering development that did it. 6 months. And we took that risk for all those years. And why did we take it? Not because we knew, but because we had done this for so long and been so successful. If we say it, we must be right. I know what I think. I don't care what your concern is. I don't care what your data says. And it only took us 6 months to solve the problem and keep right on flying for the rest of the shuttle program and not have those problems. You can't make everything perfect, but what you can do is always, always stay aware of what do I really know and why do I feel strongly about this? How much of this am I guessing? How much of it am I just shooting from the hip? Or do I think it because the boss told me to think it? The right answer is never just because. Always know why you think it's the right answer. And absolutely know how much of this is I'm just trusting what we all think. Or, geez, we just got to go. I got way off your question, Colonel Allison. Anybody else? All right, so couple things on public-private partnership. There is no such thing. The government's the big sugar daddy. Government's big sugar daddy for SpaceX, too, so I'll bash SpaceX a little bit, which is not really my soapbox. I have lots of respect for what they've accomplished, but the U.S. government has underwritten about 75% of their development costs. That's not much of a partnership. I'll say it differently. If you're going into business, find that kind of partnership. Right? And if you go back even further, guess who built not every, but 95% of all the space hardware we've ever flown in space, going all the way back to the first Mercury flight and all the way up through shuttle and space station and all the stuff I made my name in. Who do you think built that stuff? Wasn't Uncle Sam. We flew it. And some of our guys turned wrenches and put it together in Florida. But most of the people that did that, just like most of the people that built it, were contractors. Lockheed, Boeing, McDonnell Douglas, Rockwell International, Harris. I mean, boy, the list goes on and on. The list is a lot smaller now than it used to be. But it was contractors. What do I really think is going to happen? Same thing I thought in 2002 when I gave a talk that I didn't realize I was being prophetic about a year before the Columbia accident. What I really think is going to happen is we are going to make space or a low Earth orbit easy enough and cheap enough, where easy enough means repeatable enough without blowing it up and killing the people that are on the other end of the stick, that industry will finally start doing it. The reason the government has been doing it is it's really expensive. The technology is barely within our control, and only the government can spend money on stuff that you don't know how to make money on and can kill people if you screw it up. I mean, that only happens in the government. But as more and more people are jumping into the business and that cost comes down, and if and when the technology becomes more manageable so that you can do it more safely, then you'll see the government stay out of the launch and entry business, and we'll buy it off of the commercial sector, just like we do commercial aviation. I mean, imagine what the airlines would look like if the government built and ran the airlines. I mean, it would be terrible. I mean, I say this as a career NASA guy, but you know, it would be really expensive, and the ride would be loud and uncomfortable because that's what we do. Go ride in a military airplane. Sorry to the military guys, but you know, I mean, they get the job done. But it ain't a fun ride for the passengers. God, I'm gonna really get in trouble with the Air Force guys saying stuff like that. That being said, so like today when NASA flies around, we buy tickets on commercial airliners and we send our people around commercially because they do it cheaper than we do. And they certainly on a big scale, they do it better than we would ever do it. And that is gonna come along in space industry. It's not there yet. I mean, even launching on the Falcon rockets, which are incredible achievements, by the way. It is the same technology that we were using in the early 60s, and it's not marginally, I mean, it's only marginally safer today than it was 50 years ago compared to flying in a commercial aircraft. So we've got a long ways to go. I look forward to it. I frankly think the only way a real commercial launch industry replaces or becomes what we think of as, like, say, for passengers, right? So something that's like the airlines, where you and I can go buy a ticket and get into space. I think before that happens, you're going to have to get off a chemical rocket first stage. It's too much energy. You're managing too much off the pad. It's too hard to keep that stuff from exploding. Hell, SpaceX blew up a rocket on the pad just by doing a fueling test. And I don't say that to make fun of them. It is hard to manage this technology. You got to get off that first stage before we're really going to see paying passengers going into space. So one of the things that makes the rocket so darn big is not only does it have fuel in it, like an airplane or a car, but you also have to carry the oxygen, the oxidizer itself, because you start going so fast that you're blowing air through the engine so fast, the engine blows itself out. Plus, you get up high enough, there's not enough air, so you can't keep burning the fuel in the engine. So half or more of what you're carrying in any rocket isn't just the fuel, but you're also carrying the oxygen that you mix with the fuel so that it'll burn, which makes your job getting off the ground that much harder, because you're not just using fuel to accelerate this thing. You're having to carry essentially your liquid air supply all the way up into space with you. But it's also what makes that first stage so enormous. So anybody ever seen a film of the Saturn V lifting off the pad? And it looks like it's in slow motion. By the way, I was there. I've seen them lift off the pad when my dad was a pad engineer when I was a kid. And they look like that in real life, too. I mean, it looks like things going to fall right out of the sky. And it's just hovering there. And that's over 1 million pounds worth of hardware. And most of that fuel in the first stage is burned up just to get the first, 10% off the ground. Because you're having to lift all of that oxidizer, all that fuel and everything. Incredibly inefficient. If you could just get off that kind of technology, that big old rocket engine, to accelerate the first part, that alone would make it significantly cheaper, or not just cheaper, would make it significantly safer to put paying passengers on it. And we're really close. How many of you have read about things called scramjets? Anybody? You know what a scramjet is? Hypersonic vehicle? It's this engine that can actually burn regular fuel and suck air in from the atmosphere at speeds up to like Mach 5. I think right now, I think the longest sustained combustion we've had is on the order of like 1 to 2 minutes. I kind of lost track here in the last couple of years. That doesn't seem like much. 5 years ago, the longest combustion was like 10 seconds because you light it and it blows itself out. But you get that fixed. Now you do what you see Richard Branson's company doing? You know, Spaceship One, Spaceship Two? You carry yourself a big old, or a much smaller rocket in a spacecraft on an airplane. Take the airplane up to altitude, accelerate up to 500, 700 miles an hour. Well, now the rocket didn't have to do it at all. Then drop that bad boy and light yourself an engine that can get you up into supersonic speeds and light a scramjet. So you're not carrying the oxidizer, you're still just carrying the fuel to get you right up into the bottom parts of space. And now you just need a rocket for that last few thousand miles per hour. Now you're talking. Because instead of needing rocket engines that put out millions of pounds, you're looking for rocket engines that put out thousands of pounds of energy. Much different problem to solve, much safer, much more likely to put mom and dad and the kids on that thing to go into orbit or to fly around the moon than you are any of the current stuff. I could be wrong. I don't think I am on this, by the way, not just because I know what I know. What else? Everybody hear that? So first thing you do is, if you have any chance at all, bring in somebody else that knows, right? So you don't have very much time. So that means think about who you have on the team. So like in mission control, there are some things that it's come as you are. The people in the room are the only people that are going to have time to engage on this problem. And it might only be one or two of the experts closest to this system, right? So if that's the case, make sure then that you can communicate with whoever you have available to you. Here's what I'm thinking. We've got 30 seconds to make this decision. Here's what I'm thinking and why. Show of hands, anybody thinks I'm wrong. Tell me why I'm wrong. Right? Look for, as quickly as you can, indications for, here's what I'm thinking, what am I missing? And then you commit. You know, when you find yourself in a situation, especially operational things, right? So you're out in the field, whether it's space world or military world or whatever, boy, it'd be great, but something's happening. Fire's coming up out of the hole now. We're probably not going to go have a conference call now and talk to the engineers. We've got to do something now. What are the things that are available to us right now? Is this something that can kill us, or is this just something that slows us down? Depending on what that answer is, depends on how fast I move when I don't really have enough information. In all of that, though, always work hard to know, I'm going to take this action. Here's why I'm going to take it. And if you have no really good, and I'm not saying have data, but if you don't have a really good reason other than I know I can do door number one, number two, or number three, and hell, I don't know, let's just go two because I can't tell. We don't have any information, and so the best I can do is guess. Then if you can, look around at anybody else and say, I'm about to guess, because somebody might go, whoa, don't do that, idiot. We all know it's door three. Take door three. But they don't know that you're guessing if you don't tell them, or they don't know that you're about to make a decision that maybe isn't fully based on something because you either aren't the expert or you don't have time to get the data. Somebody might, and all you gotta do to get that out of your team is say, hey, here's what I'm gonna do and why. Now, sometimes, by the way, like I said on that one chart where I talked about it takes courage, you may have people on your team that'll sit there and not say anything, and when it's over, some bad thing happened. Say you break some equipment, maybe you get somebody hurt, or you lose money, screw up a project. And damned if you won't have somebody that was there say, yeah, I thought that was wrong. I thought we should have taken door number three. Well, geez, what the hell were you there for? You know, you heard me say I was just guessing. And if you knew I was wrong, why didn't you speak up? Which also means as you're coming up and as you're leading, you have to lead in a way. You have to cultivate that environment with the people who work with you, who are on your team. Hey, guys. I'm not expecting you to just nod at everything I say like I'm always right and then walk away from me and go, gosh, what an idiot. He's going to get us all killed. I want you to raise your hand and say, okay, I heard what you just said. Boy, that's wrong, and here's why. That was a really long answer to your question, but that's about as good as my answer can be. And it starts with know when you're guessing. And if you can do anything but guess, do anything but guess and tell the people around you that's what you're doing. And to whatever extent you're guessing. By the way, just last comment on that. Boy, you got me going again. I need backup music. You know what really puts you at risk? As you gain experience. So, you know, I think thinking again about my business coming up with mission control. For years, I was the white vest guy. You know, everybody see the movie Apollo 13? There's always somebody in the room, I don't go to movies. Right? So the guy with the white vest in Apollo 13, I did that job for a number of years. When you're in that job, when you speak, people listen. And when you speak authoritatively, people take action. They know you're right in whatever you say because, well, you're Paul Hill. You're the flight director. We all know. We know your resume. We know what you've done. And if you say this is so, it must be. Except for those cases where, Hell, I don't know. I was just spitballing, guys. I didn't know what the hell I was talking about. Except that you gain so much success, they listen to you on everything you say. In fact, you might find yourself in a case where you speak very authoritatively and you don't mean to, and everybody just assumes you have the data, you have the experience, you must be right. And it's the same thing as when you don't have enough time. How do you guard against that? Make sure that you're saying that out loud. Make sure you're making it clear to the people who you are communicating with, whether it's talking to them or emailing or whatever that is. Hey, I see we're doing this. Here's what I think and here's why. But I'm really just shooting from the hip. I don't have any data on this and I don't have experience in this. We need to bring in somebody that knows. And the more experience you get being successful at hard things, the harder it is to remain aware of that. But the easier it is for the people around you to think that you must just know when you really don't.